Thank you all for joining us today. My name is Leora Zack, and I'm part of the Family Office Solutions team at UBS. Family Office Solutions is a group of specialists that work with our ultra-high net worth families and family offices to provide support, services, and customized advice here at UBS. I'm pleased to be joined with Jennifer Neundorfer today, a founding partner at January Ventures. January Ventures is a venture capital firm founded by operators that look to invest in pre-seed startups. Jen was an operator who's backed 50 early stage startups. She was a partner and co-founder of Flash Starts, where she discovered her passion for investing in women at the earliest stage. As an operator, she launched and scaled media and advertising businesses at 21st Century Fox and YouTube. She is also a mom of two young children with an MBA from Stanford and a BA from Harvard. Jen, thank you so much for taking some time with us today. As we can all appreciate, our families and family office clients are interested in learning more about your experience working with family offices and how they can better identify great opportunities in this space. Before we dive into the core, perhaps you can share a brief personal intro and tell us a bit more about why you started January Ventures and how you met your LPs.
Thanks, Leora. I'm glad to be here and look forward to this discussion. As you said, I am the co-founder and managing partner of January Ventures. We're a first check fund for category-defining B2B software companies. And I spent the first half of my career as an operator, as you mentioned, building businesses like YouTube and Hulu. And my expertise is really at zero to one. And so I've been investing in early stage companies for the past 15 years, first running Flash Starts, and then starting January Ventures 5 years ago. And we started January because my experience in venture made me realize that there was an opportunity to deliver outsized returns by filling the capital gap at the earliest stage and really broadening the top of funnel for venture capital. Today in venture, if you have a certain pedigree or geography, it's very easy to access capital, but if you're outside of those networks, there can be a lot of friction. And so January is really bringing transparency and access to venture capital to drive top-tier returns and create value that is currently being left on the table by the traditional system. Our LP base is primarily institutional investors and family offices with some strategic investors as well. And we've met our LPs through a combination of network-driven introductions and also some cold inbound from LPs who saw our brand or read our content and really wanted to be involved and believed in what we were doing. We are in this for the long haul. My partner Marin and I have been building from the beginning to really build a lasting franchise in venture. And so that means that we work with our LPs to build long-term relationships, and we spend time understanding their objectives and figuring out how we can help them meet those objectives.
Great. And as it relates to your strategy at January Ventures, can you describe your sourcing, your diligence, and decision-making process, and what makes a January deal?
We're focused on B2B software companies that are bringing legacy industries up the digital curve. So we're primarily investing in industries like healthcare, climate and sustainability, supply chain, work and productivity. And as I said, we invest at pre-seed. So we're investing as the first check into a company. And this is when a company is typically raising anywhere from $500,000 to $2.5 million. We're investing in a founder who has an idea. They may have an early MVP. They are often pre-revenue. And sometimes it's just a founder. Sometimes it's a co-founding team or maybe a founder plus one or two team members. But it's very early. And so to source those founders, we've worked to develop a network that establishes proprietary channels for differentiated and scalable deal flow. And so the components of that are, first, we've built out an operator network that are about 100 executives in the tech and corporate world that are plugged into the networks that we think will source the founders we want to invest in. We've also built out our own network and come to January with our networks, but also receive a lot of referrals from our portfolio. And so the GP network and portfolio network has become a real flywheel that over time, as our portfolio has grown, has been, you know, an increasing source of deal flow for January and a really high quality source of deal flow. We've also invested a lot in our brand and our proponent, you know, our big believers that we need to be open to cold outreach. And so we have we find that founders are finding us through the content that we put out and are reaching out even if they don't have a warm intro to us. And we have a form on our website where it makes it really easy for founders to reach out and pitch us. It takes 2 minutes. We publish the questions in advance. And we get high quality deal flow through this as well and have actually invested out of that cold form. And then the final source of intros to potential companies are co-investor intros. And this is a really important piece. What we do is very collaborative with co-investors at our stage and at different stages. And so we have a network of co-investors that we are constantly collaborating with on deal flow and sourcing.
As we think through various investment strategies at a family office, why should family offices invest in a fund like January Ventures versus doing it themselves and investing directly? How have you seen family offices decide which strategy is best for them?
This is a good question, and it's one that I think is really specific to each family office and their strategy. The reasons to invest are really threefold. The first is diversification. So venture capital, and particularly early stage venture, is risky. And so by investing in a fund rather than in specific companies directly, family offices can benefit from building out a portfolio from day one. The second is leverage on time and expertise. And so we see this as an advantage, particularly for family offices that may be small or smaller or with expertise that isn't in software or venture, and they can leverage the team that the venture firm has and the expertise that they're bringing. And then the third is around network and brand for deal flow. So we talked about sourcing, and so much of that is, in venture, you need to spend the time to build a sourcing engine. And so by investing in a fund, family offices can immediately leverage the sourcing engine that a fund has built rather than building that up themselves. And what we find is that a lot of family offices want to be more private. And so they don't want to have their brand out there front and center, and that's where investing in a fund can be effective. That said, a lot of family offices do also invest directly into companies. And we found that that works really well for family offices that have a specific industry expertise. And so they already have a bit of that sourcing engine. They have a network in the industry. They know how to evaluate companies. And obviously, family offices that have large teams and really sophistication within venture tend to have a direct strategy as well. And that strategy tends to perform because they have the expertise to execute on it. And then the third bucket are those family offices that just have a real personal passion for what they're investing in and maybe are focused on a specific type of investment rather than just a returns-focused investment. And so we've seen some family offices that really feel strongly about a certain category and want to just put as much money to work there, and they aren't as focused on the returns of those investments, and so they tend to go direct. One of the things I'd say, just another nuance, is we've also seen many family offices, particularly newer family offices, start to build their venture portfolio by investing in funds and use that as a way to kind of come up the venture curve and then layer in direct investments as the family office grows, as they mature, and as their venture expertise develops.
And for families doing their own due diligence on funds, what questions should they ask of prospective funds as they evaluate and make decisions?
When we think about why our LPs have invested in January, it's because they believe in our strategy, they respect our discipline, they are impressed with our portfolio, and they believe that we can source and pick great founders. And our track record gives them confidence in our vision and our ability to do so. And they also just connect with us as people. And so I think that translates, as we think about diligence, then that translates into, one, really underwriting the GPs. Who are the partners that you're investing in? Can their partnership endure? And why are they running this fund? This is a long-term commitment, and you need to have real confidence in the GPs that you're investing in. The second is around strategy fit. So how does a fund strategy fit with a family office's goals? And has that fund strategy remained consistent over time? Diligence and discipline is a key piece, I think, of what family offices need to underwrite in any fund investment. The third piece is around track record. So both the metrics of the fund, but in a market like this, it's really important to also understand the underlying portfolio metrics. In a market like this where there's a lot of paper marks, understanding the health of the portfolio companies can provide a bit more detail, particularly on emerging funds. And I think the last place is really the reputation that fund has in the market. So talking to the co-investors for that fund, founder references, and other family offices, and really understanding what that fund, what their reputation is, what they do in an up market, what they do in a down market, and figuring out if those are the people that you want to do business with.
Great. And shifting a bit in conversation to defining what emerging managers are, would you be able to explain what this means in the venture capital space? What are emerging managers?
Leora, this is a great question because it really varies from asset class, so I'm glad that you asked this. When we think about emerging funds in venture, I think the easiest way is to think about the vintage of the fund. So typically we define emerging managers as funds 1 through 3, maybe 1 through 4. And then when you think about sort of venture, it's typically managers who are managing 100 million or less. And this is where it's really different by asset class. So an emerging manager in the, you know, hedge fund or private equity world is really different from an asset level than in the venture world. So typically funds 1 through 3 or 4 managing 100 million or less. And I think the reason that LPs gravitate towards emerging managers is that there's a belief that this is where the greatest returns lie, the potential for greatest returns. And so if you think about a manager who is on funds 1 through 3, those managers are really hungry about building their reputation. You know, I can speak from personal experience. Maren and I are out there hustling every day because we know that, you know, there's only going to be another fund if we can really prove ourselves on this current fund. And so I think that hunger and alignment of incentives on emerging managers is what makes a lot of LPs turn towards this asset class.
And what do you wish family offices would know about emerging managers that could benefit family offices, and then also how do family offices benefit people like you, emerging managers like you? So what do you both get out of this?
It's a great question because I think given the sort of size of an emerging managers fund and the way that is constructed, there's actually a lot of influence that family offices can have once they invest in emerging funds. And I think what it comes down to is that emerging managers have a lot of flexibility to help family offices meet their needs or lean into their areas of expertise. And so, you know, there's two ways family offices can invest in a fund, and those have different benefits for the family office. The first is really around anchoring a fund. And so what we've seen is, you know, family offices can come in and be a large early investor in an emerging fund manager. And what that means is they can often dictate some of the terms that they're able to get. So some family offices in that situation will ask for an opportunity to sit on the LPAC, which is the governing body of the fund. And they actually will be able to get influence and both insight into the inner workings of the firm and have greater transparency than other investors. Some family offices will also ask, when they're anchoring a fund, will also ask for co-investment rights. And that can sometimes be on every single investment, and sometimes it's on certain follow-on investments. But again, depending on the specific goals of that family office, when they anchor a fund, they're able to negotiate for some of those objectives from the beginning. For family offices that aren't coming in as an anchor, there's also just, as I said, a lot of flexibility for emerging managers to help them meet their goals. And so what we've done with some of our family offices that haven't been in the anchor seat is actually involve them in some of the diligence and sourcing based on their domain expertise. And that's something that was important to those family offices. And because we are a small, nimble team, we were able to give them those opportunities. The second area is just around direct investment. So many of our family offices that invest, they're coming into our fund so that they can get access to direct follow-on investments. And when we've exhausted the pro rata in our fund, we bring those investors in, and that's an opportunity that they really value, and the economics on that are favorable for them. And then we have a third category of family offices that are the benefit to them is that they're getting a look at new technologies. And so some of our family offices, given maybe it's the domain expertise of their principals or the businesses that their principals are in, being invested in our fund helps them see new deal flow for prospective partners, for prospective M&A, for prospective solutions in their businesses. To turn the tables, just in terms of your question of how can family offices benefit, you know, emerging and help emerging managers like us, I think the first area is just around intros to other family offices. I'm sure the saying will be familiar to many of your clients, but, you know, the saying of you've met one family office, you've met one family office, really rings true. And I think as I've talked to other managers on the venture side, the network of family offices is a bit of a black box. And so, but the one thing that we know is that other family offices know each other. And so it's helpful for family offices to make introductions for managers to other family offices. And so, you know, I think one is just telling other family offices about funds that you like and are invested in can be a real huge help, and is a big benefit. And then the other piece is sharing events with the GPs that you know and are in your network. So some of our family offices have said, hey, here are the three events that we think are really meaningful and substantive on the family office side, and you may consider going to them as you look to build relationships. And so those are all, that's always really valued from the manager side. And then the second piece, you know, that I alluded to before is just weighing in on deal flow and diligence if it's a family office that has an area of expertise. And that can be really helpful to the GPs.
Super helpful. Thinking about capital raising and the process now and pitching to family offices, what is your experience with non-family member CIOs versus family members when it comes to raising capital and pitching to them?
I'll speak to this from our own experience because we have raised capital from both. And what I've observed is that non-family member CIOs tend to be focused on either the opportunities that family members had specifically identified for them or the asset classes that they know and are comfortable with. And so in our experience, it's if an idea is or an investment opportunity is outside of either of these areas, it can be hard to get serious attention, even if it's a really compelling opportunity or investment area. In contrast, we find that family members or, you know, the principal of the family office often have a lot more leeway to promote something that they are excited about, be it a specific opportunity or an investment category. And I can give you two examples. One was one of our LPs is a family office, and the principal specifically said to their non-family member CIO, I would like to find funds that invest in founders who are outside of the Bay Area and that aren't just focused on founders in Silicon Valley. And so through that specific mandate that came from the principal, that non-family member CIO found us, but shared with us that had we proactively approached them before this mandate was in place, we probably wouldn't have any traction. And so that's one example where it kind of had to come from the principal before the non-family member CIO was willing to sort of take that risk and do the diligence on us. And so I think, you know, we do see a difference in the way that those two individuals, you know, those two groups of individuals approach investment. And I think, you know, one of the things that I am excited to see are more family members who are saying to their non-family member CIOs and staff, like, here's what we want to see, so that there's just more dialogue between those two groups and a bit more alignment.
And what do you wish family offices would know as you raise capital from them?
Yeah, going back to the point about how, you know, how family offices can help emerging managers, I think I would just echo a piece there, which is if there are family offices that want to deploy into venture, we as managers need to know where to find them. And two suggestions that I'll put out there are, you know, I think there's a lot of new events that are being formed with the express purpose of helping family offices connect with emerging managers. One is an event called RAISE. And another is a group called Equal Ventures that has the Equal Venture Summit. Those are just two. I think, you know, every day we sort of see more. But those events, I think, are really important if there are family offices that want to deploy into venture, to actually go to those and tell people that they are looking to deploy, because otherwise it can be very hard for venture managers in general, but particularly emerging managers, to find them. I think the other piece is just underscoring that, you know, emerging managers are really hungry to make returns happen. And, you know, I can tell you personally, I feel like I have something to prove, and that really is a motivating factor in just how I approach my day-to-day in building January. And I think it's one of the reasons that we have landed a lot of the family offices we've landed, because they see that hunger, and that's what they are. They recognize that from their own families, and that's what they're excited to underwrite. And then I think the third thing is just that, you know, emerging managers, I'll speak for myself, like emerging managers are excited to get to know family offices. And a fund like January, there's real flexibility to understand objectives beyond just top-tier returns and build a long-term relationship that's valuable on both sides.
Oh, that's great. And before we conclude our discussion today, it would be great if you can give your perspective on the outlook for 2024 and beyond. Perhaps you can share your thoughts and some of the things that you're seeing in the current seat.
Great question to end on. It's certainly been a turbulent couple of years in the venture world. And I think 2024, we will still see some pain, particularly in companies that are, you know, in Series A and beyond. A lot of those companies have been propped up with extension rounds or, you know, sort of insider follow-on rounds in the last 18 months. And I think that extension capital won't be available in 2024 in the same way. And so it'll be a time when those companies will sink or swim. That said, I am really bullish. And frankly, I'm more bullish than I was 2 years ago at the height of the market. I think now is a really good time to put fresh capital to work, both, you know, on the GP side where I sit, but also on the LP side. And, you know, I think that because one of the things I've noticed is that in the past 18 to 24 months, the venture tourists have left the building, both on the founder and funder side. And so, you know, I've just seen a huge change in the caliber of founders that we see who are starting companies. They're doing it even though they know that it's going to be really hard and it may be difficult to raise capital and, you know, software budgets are under scrutiny. They know they have a great idea and they're building it anyway. And I think the same thing on the GP side. We've seen some funds that haven't been able to raise follow-on funds. There's just been a streamlining in the market. And so the funds that remain have great track records and great reputations and great partners. We've also just seen valuations reset and discipline return to the market, which again is one of the reasons I feel bullish about putting capital to work. And then the constraints of this market will build more durable and valuable companies. And so founders versus 3 years ago where founders were building companies to raise more capital and it was all about how quickly companies could raise bigger and bigger rounds. In this market, founders are being rewarded for really building companies where the fundamentals are positive. And they're building to, you know, grow their revenue, grow their bottom line, build sustainable value rather than just raise the next round of capital. I think that's a positive thing for everyone. And, you know, one of the indicators that I'll share with your listeners is that as we've been speaking to investors in the last two quarters, we're seeing institutional investors return to venture. And, you know, we've talked to folks who began to pull back as the market heated up and many of them were subject to the denominator effect and, you know, were suddenly reaching their allocations of venture and realizing that the market was quite saturated. Those people are now beginning to return to venture given the reset that they've seen in the market. And so, you know, while I think there's a bit of pain for companies that are still, you know, that are midstream in this market, I am really bullish about new capital being put to work.
Well, that's great. We thank you, Jen. Thank you so much for spending time with us today. This is a great discussion. We truly appreciate it. If anyone joining us today would like any additional information, please reach out to your UBS financial advisor or anyone on the UBS Family Office Solutions team, and we'd be happy to help. This concludes our podcast today, and we thank you all for joining.
The material presented in this podcast has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. It is intended to be educational in nature. It is not an advertisement, nor is it a solicitation or an offer to buy or sell any financial instruments or to participate in any particular trading strategy, nor should it be viewed as such by the listener. UBS AG or its affiliates and its employees are not affiliated with any third-party speakers mentioned. None of UBS or its representatives is suggesting that the recipient or any other person take a specific course of action or any action at all in response to this podcast. By accessing and listening to this podcast, listener acknowledges and agrees with the intended purpose described here and disclaims any expectation or belief that the information constitutes investment advice or a solicitation of any kind. Any financial instruments or services described in this podcast may not be eligible for sale in all jurisdictions or to certain categories of investors.
As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreement and disclosures that we provide to you about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary or ask your UBS financial advisor for a copy.